For more than 30 years, film historian, educator, writer, archivist, publisher, collector, and host, Jay Duncan has curated films for El Paso audiences, nurturing their passion for classic cinema. Jay is the director of the Sunset Film Society, and this month the group celebrates films made by actors turned directors. The series began earlier this month with the screening of Orson Welles' Citizen Kane and continues today with The Night of the Hunter, a pillar of the thriller genre. It will screen today at 2 p.m. at the International Museum of Art. Here to discuss these films and why these titles are essential viewing for lovers of film is Jay Duncan. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Yes, thanks for coming back. So let's just dive right into it. As we mentioned, this month's programming focuses on actors turned directors. Why did you choose to highlight these works now?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about doing something like this for a while, and I thought we'll kick the new year off with a bang with four major stars directing movies, with two of them their first and only film. Mm-hmm. And they're both regarded as classics. You know, it makes you wonder what they could have done had they, you know, continued directing on, yeah, as well as acting.
Mm-hmm. And this one screening today is Night of the Hunter, which, you know, I had come up knowing that it was a classic film. It was one of these wonderful films, but I had no idea that the director had essentially been shamed out of directing, actor Charles Laughton.
Right. You know, I mean, I'd think it literally broke his heart because the film is kind of not really given much attention by United Artists. They didn't know how to promote it. They kind of had it on a lower half of a double bill. And so it really never achieved the recognition and the appreciation at the time of its release. And I think it was through television showings and subsequently with the Criterion remastered release of it with wonderful extras, including Mr. Laughton directing mm-hmm. some of the scenes, that it's really found its niche. I know Joe Dante has gone on record saying that he was 9. He went to a movie theater. They saw 10 cartoons and then the scariest movie I'd ever seen in my life. And so, you know, it probably traumatized a lot of young people mm-hmm. because there was no rating system, of course, in 1955, and being on the lower half of a double bill, you know, you just went to the movies. And so it's been visually appreciated by Stanley Cortez, did wonderful mm-hmm.
beautiful
photography for Orson Welles, too, and many others. So it's got this poetic look in this kind of a nightmarish Hansel and Gretel kind of a situation where it kind of stands apart from the pack. And it's a must-see, I think, for anyone interested in film.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm just going to bring this up because I love Shelley Winters. Shelley Winters is in the movie.
Absolutely.
If you're a Shelley Winters fan, it's worth
absolutely checking out. Absolutely. And, you know, people have gone on record, including Miss Winters and Robert Mitchum and Peter Graves in an early appearance, said that it was one of the most extraordinary experiences they ever had because they had an actor and a well-regarded actor mm-hmm. directing them. So he had brought a sensitivity, I think, and an urgency for them to perform their absolute best, you know, to make everyone else shine.
Yeah. Next week's film catches my interest as well. That's a film directed by Marlon Brando.
Right.
And that one has kind of a storied history. Do you mind breaking it down for us?
Well, you know, I mean, at one point, Stanley Kubrick was involved in directing. Rod Serling was involved in the writing. You know, I mean, it had this on-again, off-again situation where as temperaments and egos continue to thrash and go head-to-head with each other, it ended up being taken away from Kubrick and taken away from a lot of the people involved and given to Brando as an opportunity to act and direct in a film for Paramount Pictures. And, of course, everybody in the industry, including a lot of people that are interested in filmmaking, you know, not just people that work in the industry, including Scorsese and people like that at the time, said that they knew they were in for something extraordinary because of his makeup as an actor and bringing his personality to the set and then being basically sensitive to the material. And they didn't know what to expect, but they knew they'd expect something different. Mm. And it truly was. And unfortunately, you know, Paramount, again, you know, it was a 2-hour, 21-minute movie. It was the last film shot in VistaVision, which all the Paramount pictures were done starting in about 1954 or thereabout. And this is 1961. And so they just kind of let it languish around. They didn't renew when it came due after 28 years. It fell into the public domain. There were a lot of budget tapes and DVDs out there for a dollar, which lost all of the magnificence of the cinematography, of the VistaVision, of the clarity of the picture, of the performances. Everything suffered. And so it wasn't until a couple of heavyweights like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg got involved to throw in some money to have it restored over a long period of time to bring it back to its original magnificence. And then now it's available from Criterion as well, and we will be seeing the absolute pinnacle version of One-Eyed Jacks in its 2-hour, 21-minute format with a magnificent music score by Hugo Friedhofer and, you know, I mean, the performances, Carl Malden, you know, you have a wonderful set, Timothy Carey, Ben Johnson, all these character actors have never been better. The script works. And Brando, you know, never directed another film.
Yeah.
But it's worth seeing as the one and only Marlon Brando directed starring movie, big budget, a Western. And I urge everybody to come out and check it out.
Very cool. So, you know, as we mentioned, Night of the Hunter and One-Eyed Jacks are their only films. Your final film in the series actually marks the beginning of an incredibly long career of an actor-turned-director.
That's right.
Play Misty for Me, directed by Clint Eastwood.
I've heard of him. Yeah, this was a little film that at the time, in 1971, Clint Eastwood had an idea to shoot on his home front in Carmel, California. He was familiar with the area. He shot a lot of original locations. He plays a disc jockey with this obsessed female call-in that Play Misty for Me by Errol Gardner, and which he does. And this really paved the way for Fatal Attraction in like 16 years later. It's basically the same story in a sense, but I think done equally as well. And a sure-handed Clint Eastwood as a director handling this material with Donna Mills. It introduced the Roberta Flack song, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. It was filmed in gorgeous Technicolor in and around the Carmel by the Sea. And it's an opportunity to see how he started as a director because he's continually matured and matured and matured through the years as a fine director in addition to giving a wonderful performance. So it's an opportunity to check out the beginnings of a lot of these actors. And in the case of Charles Laughton, his only effort as a director, as well as Marlon Brando and Clint Eastwood.
And it's also worth noting, I mean, Play Misty for Me caught my eye when I found out that Jessica Walter was in it, a young Jessica Walter,
right.
And modern audiences might know her as Lucille Bluth from Arrested Development.
That's right.
So to see her, you know, in an early role, in a completely different role, is
that's
fascinating.
Right. Absolutely. I think all the films are well worth watching from an entertainment standpoint and from if you want to delve deeper into the behind the scenes. They'll be showing some extras along with the presentations. In the case of Night of the Hunter, a little 10-minute background on the visual aspects of it, the poetic aspects of it, and One-Eyed Jacks, like a 5-minute trailer, you know, that that gives nothing away. Very unusual, and it's very, very limited in scenes, mainly stills, with the wonderful music behind it. So it's a chance to see something off the beaten path, I think.
Very cool. And on the 26th, there's also a slight programming change, but it's an interesting twist on it.
Well, right. On the 26th, this will be our third. We try to do one every couple of months. It's the Iva Turney Society for Arts and Adventure. And what we like to do is explore the artistic scene in El Paso. It can be from a musician point of view. It could be from literary, graphic artist, and so forth. And we'll be featuring dueling pianos with Ruben Gutierrez and Billy Towns at 2 p.m. on Sunday the 26th, and it's all free of charge.
Very cool. So I have time for one more question. It's one that I want to kind of pick your brain on. You know, I feel like this year, streaming as a media kind of way of understanding it has really come into its own in terms of a bevy of content, but also critical acclaim and awards. So one thing that I'm curious about is how do you see streaming, you know, enhancing the appreciation of classic film?
Well, you know, it's, you know, the industry's changing. And I think that's another tool, another opportunity for mass audiences, perhaps, to get involved with motion pictures. You know, so many people don't go to the movie theater anymore, but this is an opportunity to still see not only current films, but to stream perhaps, you know, classic motion pictures. And I think it's all good because it gives the audience an opportunity. It broadens the opportunity for audiences to see things that they may not have an opportunity to see otherwise. And again, you know, like computer-generated imagery, you know, a lot of people, and me to a certain extent, were kind of down on that because it's something I think growing up with the physicality of building of sets and miniatures and stop motion animation and things like that to see things done with a computer. But I think there's room for all of these techniques. And I think if it enhances and broadens the motion picture going experience for the audience, all the better. So I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I'm waiting now for, of course, it's getting that way where there's no 35 millimeter anymore, you know, being shown in movie theaters except for Alamo and the Plaza Theater. It's getting to be where there may be one print, digital, not even a print, but zeros and ones existing somewhere on a satellite that can be beamed into all the motion picture theaters, which saves them shipping costs. Mm-hmm. So forth, but in optimal, you know, quality too. So it's just a different industry now, and they're going with what the techniques are being developed, you know. And so, as long as we don't quit going to movies, or quit watching them, or quit streaming them, or quit going to all the other avenues that there are now, other than film and movie theaters, I think it's all for the better because it continues to keep the motion picture experience alive in a different form.
My guest today has been Jay Duncan, director of the Sunset Film Society. The group's January programming slate includes One-Eyed Jacks, Play Misty for Me, and The Night of the Hunter, which screens this afternoon. All screenings begin at 2 p.m. at the International Museum of Art, located at 1211 Montana Avenue. For more information, visit internationalmuseumofart.net. On Film's producer and engineer is Seth Van Meter. An archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak, and thank you for joining me for On Film.